This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
You're listening to the Oanda Market Insights Podcast with me, Johnny Hart. Each week, we preview and review the big business and market stories with Oanda Senior Market Analyst Ed Moyer in New York and Craig Earlham in London. And it is a very good afternoon to you, chaps.
Good afternoon.
How's it going?
Very good. I want to start with you, Ed, and get the USA perspective. What was your moment of the week?
I think for me, the moment had to be in the beginning. We had a ton of optimism that came from just a wave of global reopenings across the world. And we had the EU recovery fund that was taking form. And we had a big rotation out of U.S. stocks from technology to pretty much everything that was battered throughout this coronavirus pandemic. And now we're pretty much seeing that there's a little lack of momentum here to take U.S. equities higher, global equities for that. And it's mainly because that you're having the two world's largest economies kind of resume their spat, and you're going to probably continue to see a tit-for-tat response with China and the U.S. as far as what has developed out of Hong Kong, what has happened with the Phase 1 trade deal. And there's continued optimism, I think, that you're going to have more stimulus from all the central banks across the world. So I think that many investors have abandoned that call for a retest of the March 23rd low, and now you're starting to see that if there's a ton of money that was on the sidelines that never got into the stock market rally, and now you're looking for excuses, reasons why you're going to see risk appetite leave, and I think traders are looking to see, well, how much downward pressure are we going to get from these escalating Chinese U.S. tensions, and right now it just seems that the stimulus trade is still intact, and right now I think we're looking for signs or cues that how are central banks going to evolve throughout this pandemic? And I think the risks still remain there, and that's why we're probably going to continue to see more accommodation, and that's why you're having the stock 600 still up roughly 3% for the week. U.S. stocks were up about 2%. It's been a pretty much a strong week, despite we're ending on a down note.
Yes, there's been a lot of optimism around, and as we've seen right across the world, including the United Kingdom and the USA, the loosening of a lockdown continues, and we've had more loosening measures announced over the last couple of days. From next week, people will be able to meet in their back gardens with their friends, and there are, of course, the very important news that retail outlets will be open, non-essential ones, from June the 15th, stuff like that. So there is a lot of optimism in the air. Craig, just to go back to the Chinese story, any listeners who haven't been following the spat between China and the USA this week over Hong Kong, can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, well, I mean, I say it all comes down to the introduction of Hong Kong into this spat is just another element of what was already becoming an increasing spat between the US and China once again, which started again with the coronavirus pandemic. If we take ourselves back to December, I think Donald Trump wanted nothing more than a very quiet 2020. He'd got his Phase 1 trade deal over the line. He wanted a comprehensive one. He settled for a Phase 1 because he knew he was going into an election year and he needed something, and that comprehensive wasn't going to be doable. The economy was roaring. Unemployment was at multi-decade lows. So I think he wanted nothing more than a quiet 2020. He wanted a year of campaigning. He wanted a year of telling everyone just how great life is. And when we spoke around the end of last year, we were talking about how it was almost a foregone conclusion that he was going to win this election. Everything has changed since then. Obviously, the coronavirus pandemic hit. The US has recently seen their death toll go above 100,000. We're now in many parts of the world in the most severe recession in a century. And this has completely changed the dynamic of this entire presidential election. So we started to see a big change in the way that Donald Trump was addressing the coronavirus pandemic a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, calling it very much referencing the fact that this is China's fault and the fact that this is something that has been mishandled at the early stages and that the rest of the world is paying for. And we've obviously all seen plenty of examples of that. And this seems to be the next evolution of that. It seems that this has now then evolved into many spats between the US and China, and very much the rhetoric from the Trump administration has been very anti-China throughout this. And that seems to be something that, as we've said on previous podcasts, is going to continue through now to the election in November. Now, in the last week or so, this has moved on to Hong Kong. I think we spoke about on the podcast last week about the national security law, which was being proposed in Beijing. The National People's Congress voted on this yesterday. Only one person voted against, six abstained, but the almost entire majority then backed this this bill. And this is a bill that effectively doesn't need, that will not be approved in Hong Kong itself. So this is seen as being an example now of the fact that Hong Kong is no longer an autonomous region. And that's important, because for a country like the US, Hong Kong has a special status. It means that it's separate from China, despite being technically a Chinese territory. It means it gets different rules with respect to tariffs, with respect to its entire trade relationship. And therefore, because of this change, it's deemed to have lost this element of autonomy. We don't know how the future relationship between the US and Hong Kong is going to be. But it's not just the US and Hong Kong. Many countries, including Japan, the UK, and others, over the last couple of days, have spoken out about this law, which was passed in China this week. And I think this is going to escalate into something more. But as far as the US is concerned, this is just another reason, really, for the Trump administration to really to intensify its relationship with China. And that now just looks certain to continue over the next few months, because and as we saw last year, when we see these kind of flare-ups between the world's two largest economies, it does create this element of uncertainty, and it does create this element of kind of fear for the markets. But now we're not doing it against the backdrop of the strongest economy that we've seen in more than a decade. We're doing this against the backdrop of the weakest economy we may have seen in almost a century. So that really changes the dynamic, and it creates an additional complication. As Ed said, this is a stock market that's backed by unprecedented amounts of monetary stimulus, which does have a massive impact on how this is viewed from a market's perspective. But from a purely global perspective and from a political perspective going into that election in November, it does make things even more interesting, and it does also create the possibility that we are going to see an enormous escalation, because whatever Trump announces, and we should state that we are recording this prior to the actual announcement on Friday, whatever Trump's announced, there's very little chance that China isn't going to respond. And we've seen how this goes before with this kind of tit-for-tat sanctions or tit-for-tat tariffs, as it was before, between the two. This has the possibility to become something much greater between these two countries, and it's very much almost in Trump's favor to allow that to happen, because of the view he's kind of taken towards China since this pandemic started.
Yeah, it's important for him to create a bogeyman in the situation to direct people away from any blame on him or his administration as far as the number of mortalities within this pandemic, and he certainly had some success doing that. Ed, we had a raft of figures from the US this week. First up, the second reading for GDP during the first quarter was even worse than the first. The latest figures say the US economy shrunk at 5% in the first 3 months of the year. That's slightly worse than economists had expected. Another 2.1 million Americans filed for unemployment benefit last week, bringing the total since the start of COVID-19 to over 40 million. But there was some positivity from those figures. For the first time since the pandemic began, continuing claims, which tally ongoing benefit claims, fell, which suggests the labour market is starting to rebound as businesses open. And we've seen that over here in the United Kingdom. There is certainly the momentum now for business to reopen, and we'll talk to him in a minute about the new announcements from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, on the furloughing scheme and the self-employed and so on. But I just wanted to get an overview from you, Ed, about those figures, GDP, unemployment, and so on.
Yes, very much. I think you're right that the U.S. had a lot of big data releases this week, and the key takeaway is that you're starting to see you know, I think everyone's going to believe that May is the bottom. This is when we're going to start to see the U.S. economy turn around, and it's all because of the reopening of the economy. I think the jobless claims number, we're still seeing, you know, roughly 2 million initial claims, but that key move is that continuing claims did drop, that first drop during this coronavirus period, and this is going to be something that I think you're going to probably continue to I think weigh on the outlook. You know, labor destruction is going to be a big headache for the U.S. economic outlook. And right now, I think when we take a look at what was also released today was that record fall in consumer spending. That was the second consecutive record decline. And you know, much of the U.S. economy is the U.S. consumer. And if that consumer is weak, you're gonna, you know, see I think a little discretionary spending, and that's going to ultimately drag down the economy. But there is, you know, signs that there is optimism. I think the GDP data, pretty much people are, you know, moving past that, and everyone is focused on, you know, when, you know, how bad is the consumer going to be, and everyone's looking for, are we starting to see all these stimulus programs in place? Are they starting to really make a dent in saving jobs? And as the U.S. economy starts to reopen. Even in New York City, we're starting. You know, they're expecting to have a lot of the city open up in the next 2 weeks. So that momentum is going to continue. And you know, I think for the most part, unless we see another wave of a second peak in the coming weeks, you know, the outlook is still going to be slightly more positive. But I think when you take a look at you know, what's happened on the social distancing, you know, side of things. There's been a tremendous amount of coverage as far as how Americans have rushed to the beaches. You're seeing protests start to emerge here across the big cities and also Minneapolis, and you're seeing a lack of social distancing practice. So, are we going to see another wave? I think a big part of the medical community is concerned that there is going to be spikes in new cases, and that is going to test these governors for these states, because they're going to have to decide, you know, are they going to have to tighten their grips on these lockdown measures? And if that's the case, you know, I think that no one is really pricing in a little disruption here with the reopening plan of the economy. So if that starts to fall, that will weigh on the outlook. So I think you're seeing better data, and I think going forward, everyone is anticipating that the you know, we're through the worst of it. So May data is going to start to show the turnaround for the U.S. economy.
I get the feeling that we may even be sort of following the Swedish model now, perhaps sort of 3 months overdue for some people, but not for others, in that we are willing to allow some level of pandemic to exist across the board in both United States and the UK, and maybe some other countries as well, providing that the economy gets back on an even keel, because there's a realization this cannot go on forever, this level of lockdown, because in the end, more people will die, more people will be sick, more people will, you know, become unemployed if you carry on beyond the sort of 3, 4 months that we were talking about before. And they're, in a sense, what the governments of both those countries are doing as almost a level of acceptance that yes, there will be the occasional spike, but what is a worse scenario? I wanted to quickly ask you, Craig, about today's announcement from Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He has thrown a financial lifeline to millions of workers after the government extended its support scheme for the self-employed by 3 months. I know he was under a lot of pressure, wasn't he, to extend that scheme for the self-employed, because anyone who's waged as a PAYE, pay-as-you-earner in this country, was given a lifeline, and that was extended to August. He's also said that workers will be part of the scheme that actually reduces the amount of furlough support, and it'll be, I think, 60% rather than 80%. So a bit of a mixed bag from Chancellor Rishi Sunak, but nonetheless, he has thrown that lifeline to the self-employed.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's trying to manage this situation as it evolves, and it's really difficult to do. None of us knew how this was going to evolve 3 months ago. There was estimates out there, there was guesses, there was pub chat But there wasn't really any conviction because we were dealing with something that we haven't dealt with before. And the same is very much true now. The important thing that we have to see from Rishi Sunak, from our government, from the US, from France, Germany, everywhere, we have to see flexibility. We have to see this willingness to adapt to the situation as it evolves. And it's going to evolve more and more as the months go by. We don't know if there's going to be a second wave. We assume there will be. We don't know how bad that will be. So there has to be adaptability there. We don't know if there's going to be another lockdown. We hope there isn't going to be. Trump has suggested that there won't be in the US no matter what, but I imagine that will change, obviously, depending on how bad the situation gets. And ultimately, it's always going to be a situation where you weigh up the economic versus the number of people dying. And that's not something you ever want to do. It's not a decision that I would like to make, but unfortunately, the former is also extremely important. A lot of people right now, rather than using just the measures of the people who've died from coronavirus, we're seeing a lot more talk now about the excess deaths, the people who have died either directly or indirectly from the coronavirus, which is obviously much higher than just the direct deaths itself. But at some point in the future, we're going to evolve that even more, and even that's going to be viewed as a crude measure because there's going to be what impact it had on mental health, what impact it has had on the NHS from that perspective, what impact has it had on, I don't know, obesity, what impact has it had on people's way of lives. There's going to be many different ways that we're going to measure the harmful impact of the coronavirus, and ultimately that comes down to whether you're in severe lockdown or whether you are reopening the economy. Right now, we are focused on one thing, it seems, but there is going to be many more ways to measure it. So, well, no one is saying that GDP is more important than people's lives. Unfortunately, it is still extremely important. So weighing these things up when you're making these decisions is important. The support is what really matters at this point. So when you're referencing there about the self-employment, that's extremely important. And I think what was announced today, I was watching this just before the podcast started, I think they've adopted a sensible, measured approach. They are very, very gradually reducing the support the government is offering. What they don't want is at the end of all of this, that companies say, right, now you're just ending this scheme in August. We now have to let these people go anyway, just because we're not up to 100%. And if we're not up to 100%, we can't retain 100% of staff. So by giving businesses the option and the possibility to only be paying 20% salary, I think, by the end of September, that's their way of saying this is an investment, and the only way that we can ensure this investment actually offers a return is if we slow this gradually, is if we pare this back very gradually. So I think what they're doing right now is, it seems quite sensible, but like as I say, this is a very unpredictable situation, and because of that, as long as all of these governments remain adaptable and they've all got different tactics for how they're going to get through this, and it's hard not to look to Germany when you are... when you're talking about this, because they have handled this situation so well, you've got to remain flexible, because this, I feel that we feel like we're kind of getting to grips with this situation now, and I feel like there's a lot of things that are going to surprise us now over the next 3 or 4 months, just as we start to feel confident that we're kind of returning to what's deemed the new normal. But I think everyone kind of has their eyes set on the old normal, if that makes sense.
I think most people agree, Craig. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Compared to, say, the way this crisis has been run by the UK government in terms of the health situation, the medical situation, the science, the economics, and Chancellor Sunak's right at the top of the tree as far as this is concerned, has been probably handled as well as it could have been. Am I correct in saying that? Is that the general view from the city and most of the financial bodies? I mean, without wishing to sound crude, he has had a good pandemic, hasn't he, Mr. Sunak?
This has been the most difficult introduction I'm sure any Chancellor has had in living memory, going back to the wars. And I think the response, most people will agree, has been extremely good. When I'm watching different channels, when I'm looking at Twitter, when I'm reading different media publications, people are not complaining about the government's response to the pandemic in terms of their fiscal response. No one is saying that they've not done enough. The criticism has purely come from how long it took them to lock down. So that would suggest that people broadly agree that the fiscal response has been adequate and generous and supportive, and that it has mediated the situation. It has created a situation in which the economy can recover rather than go into a very deep recession, probably a depression. unfortunately, like I say, there's always going to be criticism. That's the world we live in, and the criticism very much is being hit squarely with, and the US, I'm sure Ed will agree, is being hit with the same, and I'm sure some others are being hit with the same as well. We had longer to respond to this than, say, Italy did. Italy was obviously one of the first countries that was hit quite badly. We had longer to prepare and plan, and we were among the countries that took longer to go into lockdown. And now there's a lot more. So a lot of the kind of scathing response and the backlash has come from the decision to hold off on that. From the purely fiscal side, yes, I agree. I think I hate the term, but I agree with it. Rishi Sunak has had a good pandemic.
Yep. You mentioned Twitter before, Craig, and now you're bursting to talk about Donald Trump's little spat with Twitter on this, and I'd like to get a bit from Craig as well. But, you know, he sort of took to the airwaves, really, to criticise, or social media, to criticise Twitter more than he did China towards the end of the week. What is that all about, Ed?
I think you're starting to see that the president is doing what he does best. And right now he is trying to take the focus away from the attention of what COVID-19 has done to American lives and the economy. And he's picking new battles. And this time he's choosing Twitter and Facebook. And I think that you're probably going to continue to see the president continue to confront these social media platforms. I think that you're probably going to see that the expectations are he's going to come down on Twitter, and really he's just I think the whole story is just a temporary distraction. I think that you're probably going to continue to see markets just, you know, kind of just give this a glance over and not really put too much weight into it. But right now Trump is continuing to do what he does best, and that is he's taking the focus away from certain stories and moving them to others.
Before we talk about next week, Craig, I know you wanted to get a word in about the EU and the proposed recovery fund, 750 billion euros, which the markets liked.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a few things with this that's really important. One is the fact that this is the by far and away the largest amount of money that the European Commission is ever going to have raised on behalf of the EU27. So this is very much collective debt sharing, which is something that we haven't seen anywhere near this scale before. The second thing is that this is going to be made up of 500 billion euros in grants and 250 billion euros in loans at this moment in time. The so-called Frugal Four, which is the Netherlands, Austria, Denmark and Sweden, are very much against offering grants. They think this should all be conducted as loans. So there's many discussions to be had, and I'm sure it's very much going to be around that more so probably than where it's distributed to. But this is a massive, massive step and a massive sea change. One of the reasons why it's such a big, important change is because Germany's on board, which they're usually part of, you could probably what would be deemed now as the Frugal Five. So I think this is a really important shift should it get over the line. The obviously the alternative view is it enough and how long is it going to take and when's it going to be distributed and is it going to be effective? And all of those things I'm probably more along lines of the skeptics about, because this is something which is going to be distributed over the next 7 years as part of the EU budget. The EU budget's around 1.1 trillion euros, so this is still a significant amount of money. How countries apply for it, how they'll be accepted, where it will ultimately, when we view this back in 7 years, how much of it will have been distributed out and where to, etc., how effective it's been, it will be very much up for discussion. But that's not always the important thing, because the thing we've always talked about in this podcast is what ensures the survival of the EU, what ensures the survival of the Eurozone. And we've seen a massive rise in populism and anti-EU sentiment now for the last few years. The EU came very much at the centre of that. Obviously, we voted for Brexit a few years ago. And there's been a massive rise across Europe, but there's been a massive rise in populism around the world as well. If the EU gets this wrong, and they still have the potential to do that, if the EU gets this wrong, then it could really come back to bite them in a way, in a manner that's far worse than debt sharing. This is something where you've got Italy, which has had, which has seen a massive rise in anti-EU sentiment, where they've had the coalition parties of the left and the right, both anti-EU, joining forces, and you've still at this point got Matteo Salvini, who is rallying against the EU. We've got Marine Le Pen in France, and we've got in other countries across the EU as well, where anti-EU sentiment is rising. They have to get this right, because unlike the previous financial crisis, where it was deemed that countries got themselves into this mess and therefore they have to get themselves out, the same is not true here. The reason why Italy has been hit far worse is because, it's purely because of bad luck. The reason why someone like Spain has been hit far worse is because of bad luck. Germany has been commended for its handling of the pandemic, but Italy was very much hit first. So the viewpoint, the, from a purely political standpoint, is not going to be viewed the same way. And if what the view here, I think, is going to be, if Europe doesn't step up to protect all members, then they're going to, then people are going to, on a lot larger scale, going to turn around and ask the question, what is the point? What is the benefit? If we're not in this together, what are we in together? So I think from a purely political standpoint, the fact that they've made this, if they can agree on this recovery fund, I think that sends a really strong political message and really goes against those pushing for breakaways from the EU. So I think this has been a really important week, and it's not gone under the radar by any stretch of the imagination, as Ed alluded to right at the start of this podcast. It's one of the things which really helped lift markets in the middle towards the latter end of this week. It's not gone under the radar, but when you consider everything that's going on right now, I don't also think it's got the attention that it really deserves. And should it get over the line, it probably won't get the attention it deserves. So I think it's a really important point that needs to be made. This is could potentially be a really, really important thing as far as the future of the EU is concerned.
Okay, point made, very well indeed. Ed, before we let you go, can we have a quick preview to next week? What should we look out for?
I think the main event is going to be the non-farm payroll report. So the May jobless rate hopefully will be the peak. Last month we saw the jobless rate jump to 14.7%, which is the highest level since the Great Depression. So expectations are it's going to continue to go higher, and it's going to possibly hit 19.5%. That's going to be a tremendous amount of focus. I think you're going to continue to see, though, that there is optimism that is going to be where we start to see things turn around. There's going to be a lot of key economic data, but for the most part, it's going to be heavily focused on jobless claims. The ISM manufacturing reading on Monday is going to show hopefully some signs of stabilization in manufacturing. And then lastly, too, I think it's important to pay special attention this hurricane season. It officially kicks off. We already had two storms already that have come and gone. But this hurricane season is expected to be possibly one of the most dangerous ones since 2005, which was when we had Hurricane Katrina. So if you take a look, hurricane season, what could that mean? It could, provide some supply or some disruptions into oil. Right now, oil's about to finish up its best month ever. There's a lot of risks out there too, because if we do have some states that have to kind of evacuate right now, FEMA is a little bit stretched on as far as their resources, and you could start to see where if you have to have big cities have to move, they might have to not be able to socially distance if they're forced to kind of move to somewhere where they have to share space. So There's a big focus on hurricane season coming up, and nothing's really on radar for specifically next week, but it is the official start.
Please, let's not have hurricane plus pandemic. That really would be a shocker for so many people, wouldn't it? And as you make a good point about the social distancing and how difficult that would be. Of course, we had some severe floods in the UK just a few weeks before this pandemic started, and that would have been a real problem for the two things that collided. Final word to you, Craig, on next week.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's Ed missed off there and left for me, which was good of him, obviously, is the ECB and the meeting that we have next week. There's obviously a wide range of views on terms of how this could go. In last time, no one anticipated the new measures that the central bank announced. And it seems that more and more now, actually, central banks are delving deep into their toolkit and coming up with very new ways in order to approach this pandemic. But people are anticipating maybe around a $500 billion increase in their quantitative easing program. Whether they do that or something else, I think the message is clear that people think there's going to be more stimulus, especially as far as the euro area is concerned. So that's something to watch out for on Thursday. And then the riots that we're seeing in Minneapolis right now. This is obviously not a market story. This is very much a different story entirely. But the question, obviously, is this is something that Trump has waded into quite heavily on Twitter over the last 24 hours. And in an election year, you do wonder what impact this a situation evolving like this can have on his approval ratings, not just in that particular state, but obviously given the sensitivity of the story, you wonder what impact that is going to have with regards to Trump on a much broader scale. So that's the only other thing which I think I would highlight as far as things to watch over the next week is concerned. Like I say, I think Ed covered everything else in great detail.
Good stuff. Craig Earlham in London, Ed Moyer in New York, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was the OANDA podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.